I hope you're all well. I had a few questions I was asked to answer, written in, and happy to answer questions. Patricia asks, has Dr. Westman ever taken a patient off of Synthroid after following phase one or 20 grams total carbs or less? Phase one is the language in End Your Carb Confusion. It's page 4 if you come through the Duke Clinic and get my handout from Duke. I have to say, no, I've never taken anyone off Synthroid. And although I'm not pushing yet to take people off. So, for example, high blood pressure medicine, what does pushing mean? High blood pressure medicine, if you're low normal, meaning you're still kind of in the normal range, but you're on medicine, I'll occasionally taper the medicine down to see if you need the high blood pressure medicine still. Especially if you have occasional lightheadedness and dizziness when you stand. To me, that's kind of pushing down to see if your body adjusts and the blood pressure stays the same. For Synthroid or any kind of thyroid replacement, and I am open to the idea of using other types of thyroid replacement, like Cytomel, NP-thyroid, other than just Synthroid. This is kind of an obesity medicine teaching, and I'm past president of the Obesity Medicine Association. Most traditionally trained endocrinologists don't think about anything other than levothyroxine or Synthroid, and they say that it's just more consistent in there. But I've had people change over from Synthroid to these other formulations, and they feel a lot better. So I've learned that the management of thyroid in the clinic is not just based on the blood tests. It's based on, God forbid, how people feel. So if you don't feel like the thyroid is correctly adjusted, even if the blood tests are in the normal range, it's worth either, tweaking the dose or changing to a different formulation. And occasionally, well, the reason thyroid is so important in the weight loss world and thyroid medicine and the thyroid gland in general is that it's the main controller of the metabolic rate. So if you have low thyroid, that means your metabolism is going to be slow. And that means it's going to be hard for you to lose weight because you're just not using much energy. So if you're going to use diet as the method of weight loss, and you have a very low metabolic rate, you have to get the calories really, really low, the amount, the energy intake. And I guess I should say energy, not just, not the C word, calories, but you have to get the energy really low. And so thyroid is really important. We check it at the beginning of every program where I make sure someone has had it in the recent, in the last year, for example. I don't repeat unless someone hasn't had it fairly recently. Most people have had that checked. In fact, it's kind of a joke that the average doctor, checks the thyroid and then goes, oh, no, that's normal. Don't know what could be causing this obesity, with the diet being the elephant in the room. I've heard other doctors and other patients say, though, that they've been able to get off Synthroid or other thyroid medication. And it'll be interesting. OwnYourLabs.com is a company that Dave Feldman and Siobhan Huggins started to be able to offer lab testing outside of the typical electronic health record system so that you could have your labs be checked at LabCorp, but they're kept separate from the system. And sometimes the system shares among other folks. And so I think the company came about because there are a lot of people who had high cholesterol levels, and they were even given higher insurance rates or not uninsurable or something like that. So it was a way to be able to check the cholesterol or even any blood test and not have it be in the system. So you can get your thyroid checked at your doctor's office or outside now, and in most states, I think, but you have to check, of course, if it's available in your state. But so thyroid is not something that I typically see getting fixed. but changing it to another formulation if you don't think that you're not feeling well. And, you know, it could be what people report to me, just, you know, brain fog or just feeling slow or gaining weight for no reason or no obvious reason. Christine asks, how often are scans like the coronary artery calcium score and DEXA scan done? Every year or more often? Well, let's take those totally separately. So the DEXA scan is a way to check your body composition. You can actually look at bone density and fat composition and the amount of fat on your body. I don't really ever recommend the DEXA in my clinic. I use something called a bioimpedance machine. It's free because I have the machine in the clinic and it doesn't have any radiation. It's just a little electrical signal is sent from one arm to the other, and a part of the electrical signal is blocked by your body. And then it has a formula to calculate your body composition, fat percent, the water weight, that sort of thing. So I do that measurement in the clinic every time you come back because it's free. It shows you the fat mass loss directly. I think that really varies by the clinic, how often they do a DEXA scan. And if you're paying out of pocket, there's kind of this interesting correlation that if you have to pay and the doctor makes money from something, they tend to get it more frequently. So I don't know how often, you know, the measurement of body composition to me is almost biohacking and too much information. I don't overvalue it. In fact, I don't know that it has that much value unless there's some extreme case. So I never order DEXA scans, but some clinics do. And endocrinologists who are trained in looking at the bone mineral density and other sorts of things like that may order them for a different reason, not just weight loss and fat mass calculation. Switching to the cardiovascular system, the coronary artery calcium score is a way to measure the arteries directly. If you haven't heard me talk about this before, I've really become less focused on the blood components for cardiometabolic risk. Or if I do look at the blood, I look at triglyceride and HDL and glucose and insulin. I don't really look at total and LDL cholesterol much anymore. But even then, cholesterol is not a disease. And I know I've had everyone repeat after me, cholesterol is not a disease. The disease we're trying to prevent is atherosclerosis. It could occur on any artery throughout the body. And the weird thing that kind of occurred to me and occurred to other folks in the keto space is that there are a lot of people being treated for cholesterol who don't have any atherosclerosis and who aren't at risk for getting it. So there's an amazing assumption that every American is going to get atherosclerosis. That's not a great assumption. If it hasn't run in your family and your family ate and lives in the environment of where you are, you don't have the genetics, the loading to get atherosclerosis. I think now, and the Miami group who does a lot of calcium artery calcium scores recommend even if your calcium score is zero, you don't need statin treatment. There's no benefit from it, regardless of what your cholesterol is, regardless of what your LDL is. And in this really fantastic preliminary presentation by Dr. Budoff, the study looking at lean mass hyperresponders, basically half of the people who had super high LDLs on a keto diet, on average about 4 to 4.5 years, half of them, 40 out of 80, had no atherosclerosis or narrowing at all in any of the coronary arteries. And so this is just the baseline data from the study. They'll be following these people over the next year and repeating the scan. But in the comparison group from Miami, the Miami Heart study of otherwise normal people, it was a very similar picture. Most people did not have atherosclerosis, about 50%. and those who had atherosclerosis, it was very mild. Of course, remember to add on every study at the end under the conditions studied. So the Miami Heart Group, they're carb eaters. The lean mass hyper-responders are not carb eaters, and they have a very different metabolic profile. And so the effect of LDLs in this study going forward is going to be fascinating. There was someone who had a baseline LDL of almost 600 in this study. I mean, that I showed that to recently to a medical resident who's going into cardiology, and he went, "Oh my God!" Because, and I said, "Well, hang on. This is, you know, I'm the teacher now, the young doctor." I said, "Hang on. Is there ever an LDL level where you would hospitalize someone? You know, are you?" And he said, "Well, no." "Well, okay, relax. What in the blood do you send someone for hospitalization if it's super high in the cholesterol family?" And he said, "Well, triglycerides. If the triglycerides are 10,000 or 15,000, normally they're 150 or less. Hopefully yours are under 100. A low-carb keto diet keeps the triglycerides really low. So actually, if you have a high triglyceride up, you know, this is going from 150 to 10,000, or even if you're over 5,000 on the triglyceride, there's an increased risk of pancreatitis. And so if there's any blood marker in the cholesterol family of things that you would, it's dangerous, you put someone in the hospital, it's a triglyceride elevation, not an LDL elevation. So that person in the lean mass hyperresponder baseline data who had almost a 600 LDL had a zero score on the coronary artery angiogram. And so an important point going forward, and I will talk about this study again and again and again so you can spout off things, but it's not the calcium score we're talking about. It's the coronary artery CT angiogram. So they're actually looking at the artery, the inside of it, non-invasively. What a great study. I mean, you know, it's been a long time coming, and now because of the rolling start of enrolling people, it's going to take a year for the 100 people to go through to get the next scan. But, you know, at the low-carb conference called Low Carb USA or Society of Metabolic Health Practitioners, I was sitting in one of the meetings, question and answered, and one of the participants in the study came up and told his results. He had already had his second scan. And I said, "You know, sir, you're not supposed to do that." And he said, "I can do whatever I want." So he wasn't signed to secrecy, you know, but so he leaked that he went through the second scan and still has no disease. You know, so you know, the fear of you're on the edge of the cliff, danger, because your LDL is too high. I just don't have that fear anymore. Now, am I to say that it's totally harmless? No, but it will be very interesting to see. And the calcium score is one other way to look at calcifications in the coronary arteries. The story really, the popularization of it recently and in the low-carb keto world was because of Ivor Cummins and Jeff Gerber, who wrote a book and in there had a highlighting the calcium score. And there's a movie called The Widowmaker where someone who was totally had no symptoms of coronary disease had a calcium score, and the location of the calcium was right at the start of the two main arteries to the left ventricle called the left main. And it, the Widowmaker movie is named that because if you have a blood clot right there, it basically creates a widow because you have sudden death. If you're not like in a hospital or getting help immediately, it's hard for the heart to recover from the lack of blood flow to the entire left ventricle. So because of this serendipitous finding, this person who also was wealthy saved his life, you know, so they did the repair, what needed to be done, and then he set out to popularize the notion of getting the calcium score. Problem is, I don't know how frequently that happens. Nobody really does. Although I suppose that Miami Heart Group, with thousands of scans now, will be able to say, well, how many Widowmakers were found? But the calcium score as it exists today, if it's zero, there are studies among carb eaters that the next heart attack risk over the next 10 years is very low. Not zero, but very low. And how often you do a test, it's fascinating. I got the chance to be at a meeting, one of these low-carb conferences, with Dr. Arthur Agatston. He was invited to speak, and he's the one who, on the score of the calcium score, it's called the Agatston score. That's him. And so Dr. Agatston said, don't do the calcium score every year. Kind of shocking to all of us. He said, and he looks at a lot of these and he says, you know, every few years is fine. And they're not really looking at the number anymore. The number can go up. They're looking at the location of where the calcium is. So that requires someone like a cardiologist or a radiologist, someone trained in actually comparing these scans. I mean, I suppose you could overlap scans yourself to see, but calcium is a sign of healing in the artery. So that means there was some damage there and your body's healing it. So if you start having new areas where there's calcium, that means that there's new areas of inflammation and damage in the coronaries. So, you know, I don't recommend these tests for everyone. It really kind of was a result of how do I deal with someone who has really high old paradigm blood tests, triglyceride and HDL not in the equation, total and LDL really high. The other doctors are worried about it. You may be worried about it. Your doctor may strike fear of danger in you. So as I got into this, I don't use these in everyone. But if you decide to do any kind of diet and there's some atherosclerosis risk for all of us, some more than others, it just seems reasonable, especially in an area where we don't have long-term clinical trials, to just monitor what you can and do the best you can. But it's not a perfect test, though. I mean, even the CT angiogram that is part of this study now, Dr. Budoff and the lean mass study, is not a perfect study. So the criticisms are that they don't show a non-calcified plaque. But again, the big studies that say if you have a CAC of zero, calcified or non-calcified plaque, kind of irrelevant because those people went for 10 years without really any heart attack, heart risk. So the other weird thing is that cardiologists aren't all on the same wavelength here. Some don't want to do it. Some don't know how to interpret it. Different parts of the country have different practice styles. You know, in the Southeast where I am, you know, Duke has a lot of influence, hegemony in our area. If you were in, you know, in the Midwest, it's probably Mayo. What does Mayo Clinic do? I do occasionally go over, so short of testing, I go over the cardiovascular risk assessment, of course, based on carb eaters. You can go to the statin decision aid tool that the Mayo Clinic has. So it's the Mayo Clinic statin decision tool. Put in your data and you can get your risk. And then you can actually see what the risk would change to if you took a high-dose statin, for example. Most people who I show that to are kind of underwhelmed at the kind of change that they see in there. And it's really your decision whether you should be on a medicine like that, a statin medicine. Patricia says, what actions, if any, would Dr. Westman suggest taking if Lifeline or CAC scans show blockage? We are already following the best way of eating by following phase one. Well, I think this is a good way, not the only way, but a good way of eating. And I'm not sure if I would do anything different. So you have to remember this absence of pro-inflammatory foods, especially if you're under 20 total carbs, you have ketones going around. It's a therapeutic intervention. So if the doctor says, well, you need a drug for this, you say, no, no, I'm doing a diet. And remember, if you want to smooth the emotional response, say you're following a Mediterranean diet. And at this last meeting, someone came up to me and said, gave me the feedback, you know, you told me to say Mediterranean. I did. And the emotional response was totally different. It's not a scientific response. It's an emotional response. Or you could say modified Mediterranean if you want to, you know, be a little more precise. So I think you're already doing the best thing. So this last meeting, again, Low Carb USA or Society of Metabolic Health Practitioners, I saw some really interesting presentations, met amazing people, heard great stories, spent a day with parents of type 1 patients, with people with type 1 diabetes, or even people with type 1 diabetes themselves, and heard some just remarkable stories of success, remarkable stories of doctors bullying the parents, and because, you know, they're not eating enough carbs, their children. And even in that world, the one person there was threatening of getting social services involved because they weren't feeding their children enough carbohydrates, which would raise the blood sugar. And so I suggested that, well, why don't you just create a form where the first checkbox is, you know, carb counting. So that's what doctors want to know, that you're counting carbs. Don't tell them how many you're having, though. And then what you do is you show the glucose monitor, which these are like perfectly normal flatline glucoses in these type 1 patients because they're not eating many carbs. And they're taking insulin that keeps the just enough insulin to keep it not too high and not too low. And then the A1C, which is the summary measure. So you have the, you know, checkbox on Monday, carb count, here's the glucose, here, and then the A1C, and then just show that to the doctor. Just focus on the outcomes, not the process variables, not how you do it. And, you know, that's come to me by other people telling me that the doctors say sometimes, well, don't tell me what you're doing, just keep doing it because everything looks good. But I can't write down you're doing a high-fat diet. It's what they're saying, because that might get me into trouble, or, you know, passively allowing you, you know, not actively discouraging you. Yeah. So I said, well, you know, why not do this? And then one of the parents said, well, you know, we kind of tried that, and the A1C is so low that they figure it out. So the children are so well controlled. It is so different than what they typically see in the kids who eat carbs, that they kind of go, your A1C is 4.5. You're not eating enough carbs. Oh, my goodness. So this is the type 1 diabetes community, the Facebook group Type 1 Grit, TYPEONE, spelled out GRIT, is the focal point for this group. Although one of the parents spun off and has a company to help parents do this. Another parent helps Adapt Your Life Academy write a course. And then there's a nonprofit called Let Me Be 83, which helps people with type 1 diabetes. Let Me Be 83 is the code or mantra based on Dr. Richard Bernstein's idea that the perfect glucose is 83. And Dr. Bernstein cites a paper where, you know, these people live the longest. And so Dr. Bernstein strives to stay at about 83 by checking blood sugars and even having a little glucose if the sugar is too low. So he really has micromanaged it. And now he's almost 90 years old with type 1 diabetes. He had kidney failure in his early life from the diabetes and reversed that. And so it's a great story. We talked about Dr. Bernstein. We talked about Dr. Runyon. Keith Runyon has type 1 diabetes, wrote a book with Ellen Davis, helped Keith write a book on his method of doing it. And so that was all at this recent meeting. There was another talk by a cardiothoracic surgeon, Dr. Philip Ovadia, And I was impressed. I really liked the talk was about inflammation and heart disease. And of course, in a book that I helped to write a decade ago, we wrote actually the summaries and sometimes verbatim interview from the researchers of cardiovascular disease, and they were talking inflammation, you know, 10 years ago. And so now the research is still among carb eaters. And of course, the research done is about giving drugs to change the inflammation or just the association of inflammation and heart disease. Curiously, Dr. Avaidya didn't know about the Virta Health study. And so I sent him those papers and afterwards, and hopefully he'll add that to his data. Because, well, so in the Virta Health studies, they've shown now that they can reduce the inflammation as well as or better than statin drugs. So this is the study they did with type 2 diabetes. The 70% of the folks get off insulin in the short time that they had with them. And that company has done well now, connecting with health organizations, even VA, and I hope that that grows. My concern is that it's pretty high tech, right? Coming out of Silicon Valley, where everyone's high tech, and not everyone wants to check their own glucose and ketones and step on a Bluetooth scale, and not everyone has. Well, no, everyone does have a cell phone now, but talking to a doctor in their app to get off the medicine, that's the method of the Virta Health model. But so the diet change you're doing is lowering inflammation, like taking a drug. I know that might be hard to understand. It may even be harder for doctors to understand, because today it seems to me medical care has become medication care, a doctor prescribing this and even prescribing a medicine for the side effects of a medicine. But one of my friends who does a lot of the Ozempic and Saxenda and Wegovy.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
They hand out a prescription for nausea at the beginning. So, well, okay, that's one way to do it. Recently, this medical resident who had great training and even nutrition training in his past, at the end of the morning with me, was just kind of shocked because the discussion is different, the concerns, well, we're all concerned, but the idea that you have to give a medicine, it really has become an indoctrination. You know, it's a practice model that is not the only way to do it. So I'm not sure what to add to what you're doing already if you have coronary artery disease. And I say that, and I know, so Dr. Avaidya, this is why I thought of it, recommends an anti-platelet agent and vitamin K2 and all that, because in the context of those who eat carbs, there's some benefit for those things. But what about the side effects? So these things are not totally benign. To take an anticoagulant, even if it's a mild one, has some issues. And then I'm reminded of the one health concern that the Inuit had when they were studied in their pristine situation. They weren't affected by Western food yet. The one thing that they seemed to have an issue with was nosebleeds. And thinking back how that could be, they may have had the fish oils, the omega-3s can actually make the blood a little thin. And so you may actually be getting an anticoagulant effect by the foods that you eat compared to those wheat carbs and aren't eating the fish, the meats, where the omega-3s are. It's a conjecture, but I'm not sure, you know, until a drug is studied among those of us who don't eat carbs, you don't know that it's going to be helpful. It might even be harmful. I don't mean to make you worry. The risk is low, I suppose, if you're on a drug when you ate carbs and now you're not eating carbs. It kind of depends on the drug. But scientifically, you know, to be really pure about this, a statin medicine given to someone who doesn't eat carbs might harm them. I'm not quite sure. Well, okay, you're blocking the major compound every cell in your body needs. But so adding even things like vitamin K2 and the nano something is what they're saying you should have if you have coronary disease. I'd like to see that study in people, and more than, you know, 50 people. This is my classic, show me a study, 50 people over 6 months, and I'll comment on whatever you're talking about. Someone says, well, what about the blankety blank diet? I'm like, well, show me a paper. It's 50 people over 6 months, measure something and publish it. I mean, that means you've actually like assembled the information systematically. We did that in 2002 for the program that we teach. And then, of course, studies have been done ever since with randomized trials and more closer scrutiny. Christina says, how about the topic of taking any recipe and making a KMS version, ketomate simple version? All right. I looked at all the food picks here, and for the most part, the meals are pretty basic. Maybe that's why the boredom. What boredom? Sorry. I had someone who was so thrilled with her successes that the resident who was shadowing was just overwhelmed that you could have fun in a medical clinic, you know? But so boredom can happen. That's one reason why we ask people to come back or touch base to talk about it. Not everyone gets bored, though, eating the same things. So don't, if you do get bored, don't feel like everyone's going to. But I like that. So how about to the admins in the group or Christina, kind of work through that a little more. Chef Scott Parker put together the End Your Carb Confusion cookbook, the companion cookbook to End Your Carb Confusion, the book Amy Berger and I wrote. And it's an award, it won an award at a keto conference last year, the End Your Carb Confusion did. Chef Scott has worked in Michelin star restaurants for 20 years, put together a great volume on how to make things quickly, taste and tasty, all fresh kind of ingredients. So he has the book, and then he even wrote a course for the Adapter Life Academy. And I guess this is a worthy of a formal announcement that there are more courses now that are available to sign up for at any time. It's called an evergreen course. So we have now 4 or 5 courses. If you go to the Adapter Life Academy and check them out, they are open for enrollment now. That's Chef Scott's cooking course is one of them. The Protein Power protein course that Mike and Mary Dan Eads wrote, which is really pretty fabulous. And it gets a lot of the just kind of wisdom of these two doctors who worked their entire practice together in a low-carb kind of practice. Mike and Mary Dan Eads wrote the course on Protein Power. So we don't have the KMS or Ketomate Simple as an evergreen yet, and I'm not sure we will, because we want to get people started, and we have continued to have a 3-week dedicated social media group so that we can get people over those first 3 weeks. The KMS 10 group is just now in their Facebook group, by the way. So you can look forward to inviting in some more people soon. And so be on your best behavior, please, for the newcomers. Let's see. Radha says, what happens when you're a yo-yo dieter? How bad is that for health? Well, you know, I'm not sure what the definition of a yo-yo dieter is. You know, if there's really, the concept is the idea that you lose weight and regain it, lose weight and regain it. How much weight probably matters in terms of how it is good or bad for your health. If you looked over the lifetime of somebody and weight is a factor toward being, harming the joints, having metabolic illness, and half your life is in a lower weight, half your life is in a higher weight, I don't know if the process of gaining weight and losing weight is I don't know that that's the issue, really. It's where you are in inflammatory, the weight-bearing problem that happens. I know a lot of people will kind of knee-jerk say, yo-yo dieting is bad, and therefore take these pills or take the shots or something like that. So if you follow a program like this one that's simple, it's easier to follow. And yo-yo dieting in the past, for example, you might have followed some stars who will lose a lot of weight, then get off their program, then they regain the weight. And now the medications seem to help some people, so they don't have that. The particular star I'm thinking of is a carboholic. Going back to Jackie Eberstein and Dr. Atkins era, and if you never wake up one day and say, I am a carboholic, I really can't have sugar, then you're going to be struggling. That's what's going to happen. And medicines can help for that. I'm not against using medicine, but it certainly shouldn't be the first thing you try. What I'll do is say, here's the low carb keto diet. We've been using it for 25 years. We've studied it, published papers on it. If you want my advice, I'd say let's start with the diet by itself. And if you learn a simple system, it's easier to follow. And this is a way to keep the weight off really forever. And you don't have that yo-yoing. There was a popular study based on that TV show called The Biggest Loser. And they found that the metabolic rate of these folks who lost massive amounts of weight fast and using exercise and basically not eating much. That was an interesting lecture I went to at the Obesity Medicine Association. The dietitian from The Biggest Loser show came and gave a talk, and she said, I'm upset with the show. I have no control. And what people do basically to try to win is they don't eat anything. So she said they have a fridge of great foods, they're given a calorie counter, but there's no enforcement of eating. And so basically she was concerned because, what would you do if you were trying to win, I don't know how much money you would win, and you wanted to lose this fast? Well, of course you wouldn't eat. You would starve and then exercise. And then that's why they were passing out. And now it's great TV, but it really was torturing people. I guess it was self-inflicted. So the metabolic rate can go down, and then you're struggling with, again, that situation like very low thyroid, where you can't eat much in order if you're going to draw upon your body fat store. And the idea of using medications is worth thinking about. Again, I start with a low carb keto diet as a first line treatment, of course. Some chat room. Thank you. And again, it says my magnesium level is low. I'm trying to normalize it. I was told it can hinder weight loss. Well, magnesium. So this is interesting. Steve Finney, like E.F. Hutton said, Steve Finney says, we measure the blood because it's convenient. Not that it really tells us much that's important. Wow, what a statement. I ruminated over that through the years. So magnesium in the blood is not a good measure of magnesium in your cells. There is a measurement of magnesium in the blood cell itself. You have to send off a special one. So that it, so it just complicates the whole picture. But you want to add magnesium if it's low, magnesium supplementation. The only time I had trouble getting someone's blood levels like that up, even iron levels, is if someone has had weight loss surgery in the past and they have had a rerouting of the intestine or a lopping out of part of the stomach or where you can't absorb the nutrients correctly. A subset of folks who have Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, which is the strongest version of bariatric surgery that's out there today, and it has some severe side effects too. A proportion of those folks, I think it's 30%, get iron deficiency anemia, and they have to be on iron all the time. And iron, of course, gives you constipation and all that. A subset of those people have to be given iron infusions. In our area, it's at the cancer center because they're the only ones that really do iron infusions. There's a quirk with it that it can't be given too fast. It's not safe to do it, and not every nurse or clinic is set up to do it, but the cancer center in our area is. And so every month, these folks have to go get an iron infusion because they can't absorb it. So I have not heard that it hinders weight loss, but I think it possibly could, I suppose, if magnesium is such an important electrolyte. Let's see. Sue says, confused about the CT artery scores that were discussed for the Feldman group. Okay. I've had some kind of CT coronary artery calcium done, but the test indicates the score could be from 0 to 400. These are different tests. Yeah. The Feldman one is not one you can just get easily. It's a CT angiogram, it's called. So you have a dye that's given into the vein. It lights up these arteries. A CAT scan is done, CT scan. So if you have a coronary artery score, I've had one, you lie down in there and there's no intravenous contrast material that's given. So that, and some of the score, the artery score that in the Feldman study went from 0 to 45. That's it. So when you're looking at their figures, and I go over this in a YouTube reacts recently, the scale, most people are just super low in terms of any kind of disease. So if you have a score of 18 in the left main and circumflex, and so not sure. And that's the problem with this calcium score. So if it's zero, it's really meaningful. If it's not zero, we're left with, you may have had total healing in that area. You may still have some residual blockage. That score doesn't say. I'm hearing a lot, Janet. Hey, Janet. I'm hearing a lot about ultra-processed foods lately. I wonder how many of our ills are attributable to them. Yeah, a lot. Seems there are very few high-carb foods that are not ultra-processed. Maybe potatoes, beans, some fruits. Well, so one of the commonalities of all of the diets that work or have been studied, and you lose weight or have improvement in metabolic health, pretty much they exclude sugar and ultra-processed food. All of them. Is it possible that all of these diets are healthy just because there's no junk food? Yeah, sure it could. Or that's a major, major reason why. And our little, spats about what the best diet is are irrelevant or overvalued, or it's a false choice kind of thing. There was a sub-analysis of a Stanford study that looked at the two extremes, an ultra-low carb and an ultra-low fat diet. Those who were following them, they both had good reduction in insulin resistance. So they both worked. People lost weight, they had improvements. And so the tactic of how you do it may be less important than the fact that you just cut out the junk foods. Yeah. Well, now be careful. There are keto junk foods out there now. The saying is, if it says keto on it, be very careful. Always look at the total carbs, not the net. Net carbs to me is like over-the-counter medicine. It can work for some, but if you want prescription strength, right? Use the total carbs. Janet says, does the ALA phase two, up to 50 total carbs per day, provide similar benefits to as compared to phase one?
Now, that was when you were talking about how phase one can be anti-inflammatory.
Yeah.
About the heart stuff.
Well, so here, that's a great question. And the I haven't seen it studied head-to-head yet, which would be the best way to determine it. And the theory, so let's say you cut carbs down and the carbs are pro-inflammatory, so you're getting the benefit from not eating the pro-inflammatory carbs. That should apply to phase one and phase two. But phase one, if you're ketogenic, kind of the unanswered question is, what is the added benefit of the ketones? And, you know, it's in its early research, there are those who are early adopters and say, oh, you need ketones around. It's so great. It's anti-inflammatory. And here's the number you need. And here's the meter you check. I'm not so convinced yet. But I'm open to that idea that you may get added benefit from extra ketones. If you remember back to the whole hoopla about metabolic advantage, Dr. Atkins said, you know, my diet, it has an advantage, and it's because, you know, the hormones are different. And, well, you know, and then the people said, you're a quack, there's no advantage, a calorie is a calorie. Well, we have the science now that basically says the metabolic advantage is, on average, 100 calories a day. Is that a lot? It is in some ways, because it's been argued that if you're just 100 calories off per day, that means over a year you're going to gain 10 pounds, right? But the most of the benefit of a low carb diet comes from the caloric intake reduction, that you're eating less. Of course, that was obvious to me in our first research study. We calculated what people were eating and they ate less. Yeah, there's no metabolic advantage. It's a low calorie diet. So I always kind of knew that this was much ado, about not much or a lot, depending on how you look at it, 100 calories a day. So now the extra ketone benefit, how much is it? I don't know. So we're kind of like, oh, is it extra ketones? Is you get to create? Well, but how much? Oh, and do I really have to check this and that? And well, there's word on the street, there's a continuous ketone monitor being developed. So you won't have to do your finger sticks for your ketones anymore. Of course, any biohacker knows you can get a continuous glucose monitor. So I don't know what the incremental benefit is of being in ketosis. I think if someone wanted my best advice of treating something like cancer or epilepsy, or Alzheimer's or something, you know, that's serious like that, you might want to check the ketones and see if they're, well, do that extra effort, because at least in those areas, it seems like having ketones in the blood is especially a good thing. But it's kind of still early and mostly theory or animal studies, that rodents, not humans. So, you know, if it's easy for you to be in phase one, why not stay in phase one? If it's not, if you like to be in phase two for the variety, or you know, the flexibility, it seems reasonable to me at this point. Now, if you were a avid exerciser and you had the natural tendencies to burn fuel really easily, like one of my brothers, you might do phase three. You know, you're exercising all the time, you're running on the beach hours, and that allows for up to 150 carbs per day. Of course, eliminating the highly processed sugar and junk foods. So, although I have to say, and my brother will never watch this, he has had a hip replacement. We're about the same age. And so because I didn't do the athletic stuff, didn't go play basketball, didn't jog all the time, play tennis, that wasn't my natural tendency, I still have my natural hips. So now factor in, you can do all that, but then do you want to have joint replacements? I mean, it's kind of like what people are doing now. So, you know, is that doesn't necessarily mean it's good or the best thing. I think Amy's Straight Talk Tuesday yesterday addressed boredom. It was great. Fantastic. Glenda says, I took Chef Scott's course and it was first when it was first offered. It was great. Very informative. I recommend it. Thank you. Thank you, Glenda. Yeah, the course, the eggs that are in the Andrew Karp Confusion and the course scrambled eggs. Wow. Game changer. Be sure to check out Chef Scott's scrambled eggs. They're super delicious. And then also the collie rice is something I do all the time because you have fresh cauliflower, chop it to your consistency that you want. You only chop up the amount you're going to use, put it in a microwave, 90 seconds twice with some butter, well, a lot of butter, and some salt and pepper. So these quick and easy sorts of things with fresh food that is the way that Chef wrote that cookbook. Yeah, Andrew Karp Confusion Cookbook, right? And the course. Anne says, I should have mentioned that my cardiologist is concerned because magnesium was so far below normal range. I already have atherosclerosis. Yeah, well, I would want your magnesium to be normal too. So in the treatment of muscle cramps, I found that liquid version of magnesium, the milk of magnesia, seems to get absorbed better. So if you're having trouble getting magnesium absorbed through pills, and SlowMag is one that has a lot of positive comments about it. Finney likes that one. Finney says, but you might try milk and magnesia as the source to see if you can absorb it better. And I say absorb it better because people will come to me with muscle cramps and I'll say, well, take some milk and magnesia at bedtime, 1 teaspoon at bedtime for a week. And they say, well, I'm already on magnesium pills. I say, well, but you're having the cramps. You're taking the pills. It's not enough, or you're not absorbing it. And so I switch them, or no, actually add the liquid form, and then the cramps go away. So that's kind of a recurring signal that I've gotten to really kind of, yeah, try the liquid. Don't quite know why, but I think you may absorb it better. Yeah, so Janet says, I'm happier on phase two, so a little higher carb level, but I don't want to miss out on the health benefits of phase one if the difference is significant. Well, that's a great question that hasn't been answered satisfactorily in my mind. The low glycemic diets, this is the, you know, higher carb. The Harvard group, David Ludwig, studied low glycemic diets. I suppose you could do a comparison looking at the average changes and between different studies. But then another thing you can do, I've done this in my clinic, is try one dietary pattern, phase one, measure the CRP, C-reactive protein, for example. Have some measure the triglyceride, the HDL, the glucose metabolism. Then switch over to phase two for 3 months, say, and then check all of those parameters again. Of course, these are blood parameters. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to live longer, have better health, but at least it gives you a signal about the direction that your body is going. And those kind of measures are just simple blood tests to do. But I think that if someone endowed a center on keto diets, I think that's a question that needs to be answered. Is it really beneficial to be super low for a long time on the carbs and to have those ketones around? The early signals look good, but it's not yet up to human clinical trials. So, you know, I couldn't with the confidence of giving a drug or giving phase one, page four, that food list. I'm very confident. I'll say, you know, if you do this, it's going to work. I have no doubt that it will work because it's been studied that much. But I couldn't say really that having ketones around and being phase one is definitely better than phase two. It's funny. So I get feedback like, wow, it's great. You say, I don't know. And then I get feedback. You say I don't know too much.
Something went wrong. Please try again.
Siri, I wanted to get involved somehow. It reminds me, someone came to the clinic once recently, and I said, well, you know, how many carbs are in it? Well, she pulled out her phone and said, okay, Google, how many total carbs in the blankety blank? And it said right back. So I would use these resources, and, you know, I'll kind of, someone asks, well, how many carbs in a sweet potato? I said, well, do you have a computer? Or do you have, you know, so, and I'll demonstrate, I'll go. Nutrition facts, sweet potatoes. And I'm reminded that, remember, a fistful or a cupful of rice is 40 carbs. Oh, my goodness. You know, I usually say an apple fistful is 20 carbs. You know, wow, that's, and you know, you only have 5 grams in your bloodstream. So no wonder your blood sugar goes up after eating an apple. And now, you know, being reminded of rice, even brown rice and other kinds of rice is really high. That's why you don't want to have much of it if you do. I'm in the middle, almost done with this book, Rethinking Diabetes, Gary Taubes. Fantastic. It is the story of how low-carb diets were used routinely 100 years ago and then got messed up. Not with any science. It was more just the, well, people want bread and we can give insulin and keep it down. And in there, Gary basically says, will the doctors wake up and do research to help their patients? You know, he kind of ends, it's a, knowing Gary, and actually I read this book before it was published, gave comments, and so did Amy Berger. We got to read it and help Gary, well, hopefully edit out some things and make things clearer. But the ending sentence is just, easy as it is for diabetologists and physicians to continue believing that what they should be doing is what they've been doing. They should be doing is what they've been doing. They do not serve their patients best by doing so. Wow. A must read. You know, if you remember good calories, bad calories, that was a pioneering work and helped me understand why we got into this low-fat mess. This is similar. The story of drugs taking over. And at the same time, I'm not sure who's going to read it. You know, the response by a different author who is not a physician, but wrote a book on diabetes was kind of flippant. It was like, you know, Taubes says it's all just because of carbs. You know, how can it be that simple? Like, it is that simple. So anyway, the good news, I think, is that the medical world, even within the drug prescribing world, is shifting toward medicines for type 2 diabetes that don't make you gain weight. So the Mounjaro, the Ozempic, most people lose weight with that. The downside, though, is sometimes it's so strong, people don't eat anything. And so they're basically getting an unhealthy reversal of their diabetes and weight loss by using a medicine. But that's what they're trained to do, is use medicines. So, but it's a great book. And then, of course, the other great book, if you wanted to try to convince your doctor or loved one, Ketogenic, is, you know, the book, Science. And just even as a show and tell, I'll use this. And Dr. Yancey and I contributed 2 chapters into this book, the ones on nutrition and on the use of low-carb diets for diabetes and obesity, which is really our starting point. But so be like the egg on there. That's, yeah. Well, I think that's what's on my mind at this point. And keep doing what you're doing. Spread the word. The energy at the Boca Raton Low Carb USA Society for Metabolic Health Practitioners was super high. It's you know, always just thrilling to get together with other people. And although someone had a husband who traveled there with her have appendicitis, and locally they got hospitalized, and fortunately the doctor did this amazing thing where they take out the diseased appendix. It's amazing. You put them asleep, you open the, you do a little surgery, pull it out, clip it, and then it's miraculous. It's like you saved the life of this person. And so meanwhile, we're at this meeting where someone's lost 50 pounds. Everyone's, it's like, wait, we should get that surgeon over here and thank him for saving this life. Well, wait, that's what they're trained to do. So we're trying to train more and more people and coaches and you know, doctors are too, they're overtrained to become a health practitioner. You know, we don't need to train someone how to be taking out appendices. We need to train people to communicate and tell people not to eat carbs and then know the safe boundary of, well, you know, you're on medicine. You really need to talk to someone else about this. So it doesn't have to be difficult to teach. And it should be so routine that, you know, nobody clapped for that doctor. Of course, I'll bet the first time the appendix was taken out in a, you know, theater in Boston or wherever it happened, they were clapping. I mean, it is heroic. It's amazing what surgeons can do. And now it's so routine, you know, of course the family comes in. Oh, thank you, doctor. But it's not like we have conferences where we clap for surgeons anymore. We don't need that. So one day, maybe, everyone will know that it's so commonplace and routine and expected to reverse diabetes by cutting carbs that we won't have to be, you know, clapping. And you know, although it's great to see and people feel so much better when they do have those kinds of results. So. My pleasure to be with you tonight, live and on the replay. Thanks for watching in. And until the next time, you know, enjoy the food. Check out the other courses at Adapter Life Academy. They're really kind of handpicked to be the creme de la creme in the low-carb keto world. Take care. Bye-bye. If you enjoyed this video, be sure to like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell, and check out AdapterLifeAcademy.com.